Welcome to the Leadership Window podcast with Dr. Patrick Jinks. Each week, through a social sector lens, Patrick interviews leaders and experts and puts us in touch with trends and tips for leading effectively. Patrick is a board-certified executive coach, a member of the Forbes Coaches Council, a best-selling author, award-winning photographer, and a professional speaker. And now, here's Dr. Patrick Jinks.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 141 of the Leadership Window. I am excited about this conversation today. We are going to talk about performance and some other things, but we're going to talk leadership, and this is a show about leadership. Bill Benjamin is my guest today. He is a leadership expert guru. He's an emotional intelligence specialist. You've heard a lot of emotional intelligence content on this show. He is a partner at the Institute for Health and Human Potential. I just love the name of that organization and want to know a little bit more about that. He's got a background in mathematics and computer science. I know, you're already going, okay, and this is a leadership conversation. Yes, it is. Bill brings a unique analytical lens to the human side of leadership. He helps high-performing teams and technical leaders navigate pressure, build trust, have the difficult conversations that most people avoid, which is probably the number one challenge I find myself coaching leaders on, is the ability to have those conversations and the skill at having them. He co-developed a framework they call the last 8%. And we are definitely going to get into that concept on the show today. But it's a science-backed model for courageous leadership. He's worked with elite organizations from the U.S. Marines to NASA, Google, the NBA, people who take leadership pretty seriously and who work under pressure a lot. Bill is also, he's a sought-after speaker. He's known for blending data, storytelling, and vulnerability to create practical, high-impact learning experiences. I will tell you this now, and I'll tell you at the end of the show, more information is at IHHP.com. IHHP as in the Institute for Health and Human Potential. IHHP.com to learn more. And the book for this with this partnership with he and his partners that is already out is called Performing Under Pressure, The Science of Doing Your Best When It Matters Most. I've already read just a slight bit of that, and there's an interesting and unique take that I think we'll talk about. But I also want to make sure we talk about the last 8% culture. So with that, let me say howdy, Bill, from Chicago, if I'm not mistaken. Thank you for joining us today.
Howdy, Patrick. Great to be here. And I loved your intro. Whenever I hear myself described as an emotional intelligence expert, I always think, not according to my teenage daughters.
Yeah, I know. I know. It sounds a little like, you know, presumptuous to say I'm an emotional intelligence expert. But there is the understanding of the framework and helping people understand what it is. Yeah, it makes you expert in the field for sure. I certainly want to dig some of that expertise out. So, what did I miss in my introduction that you want to tell the world? What's your mission? What are you helping people do the most?
I mean, we're really helping them understand how to be high performing, how to show up in their most difficult moments, not avoiding them, but also not making a mess, finding that middle ground where they can push through the discomfort, take a risk, make a tough decision, have a tough conversation, yet do it skillfully. That's some of what I've learned in the last 24 years of doing this. And it's really helped me in both my work and personal relationships.
You've already got me wanting to dig right into something as you say that. There is a term that is used a lot in the organizations I'm working with. You've heard it a million times. You may have shared it and taught it a million times. And it's the term psychological safety. Mm-hmm. And I hear it a lot that leaders are supposed to create psychological safety in their environment. And I've come to recently challenge that concept a little bit. And we can talk about that, but I'll just share kind of where I'm headed with this and get your take on it. You know, the ability to have these conversations and to be comfortable working through conflict and challenge that as you just talked about requires what people would say, well, that requires psychological safety, which means Mm-hmm. If I'm going to challenge leadership or peers or, you know, cross sector stakeholder groups, I got to feel like I'm not going to have to pay a negative price for it. There's not going to be a consequence of, what's the word, the HR word, repercussions. You know, I'm not going to face any of that for speaking up. And so I don't feel psychologically safe. In some of the work that I've done with some cohorts I've been in with Dr. Peter Hawkins and others, we've challenged that term psychological safety because it implies that I'm responsible for your psychological safety. Mm-hmm. And when you really think about that for 5 seconds, it's like, yeah, really though? And so the term I've started using is psychological maturity of an organization and its culture. In other words, are we mature enough not only to recognize that we want to open space, but we're also mature enough to be able to take the known risks of speaking up. There's risk no matter how much psychological safety a leader can give to you. So we can talk a little bit about that if you want. I'd love your take on how do you help leaders navigate that when you can't really guarantee someone else's psychological safety?
Yeah, and you're right. I think the term is overused. I still think it's important because if you want to create a culture and a team where people show up and perform a specific set of behaviors, have a specific attitude, there's really two pieces to it. The research is really clear on this. There's their own internal capabilities. Do they feel comfortable taking risks to speak up? Do they have the skills to do it well? That's the internal, but that's only 50%. The other 50% is the external environment. So if you want to create a culture where people speak up, but senior leaders are shooting their ideas down, people aren't going to speak up. So what we're really working with organizations on is having both, where there's that safety where leaders are A, modeling it, and B, being open when somebody's pushing back at them, when somebody's speaking up. So it really is both.
Yeah, and that reminds me a little bit of some conversation that we've had with folks lately around vertical development versus horizontal development.
Yeah.
There's a skill set required to have these conversations, which is a competency, but there's also a maturity necessary to have these conversations, which is a capacity. And oftentimes we diagnose wrong. We try to teach the competency when the capacity's not there, or someone has the capacity, but they just don't know the skills for that. So it's kind of double-edged.
Yeah, we're trying to teach both. I mean, the other thing that we know from how the brain works is that it's actually the culture is established. People's feeling of whether it's safe or not to speak up is actually established in the difficult moments. Now, we've defined that through a research study of 34,000 people, that on average, people feel that they leave 7.56, which we rounded up to 8%. They leave 8% out of a difficult conversation. They get 90, 92% of the way there. It starts getting tense, it starts getting difficult, and they step back, they avoid. They don't say that final last 8%. And the reason that last 8% is so important is because of the cortisol effect. And the cortisol effect is that when there's tension, when there's pressure, when there's conflict and uncertainty, cortisol gets released into the brain. And one of the things that does is it causes memories to sear in. So people remember how you showed up in that difficult last 8% moment. They don't remember what you're doing in the 92% of moments when everyone was getting along and the deadlines were being met. So culture is really established. Psychological safety is established in those tough moments. So we're really helping teach the skills for people to, again, push into that discomfort of approaching a tough moment, yet doing it skillfully and either modeling it or being open to creating that psychological safety, but especially in the tough moments, because that's what people remember.
So you just opened up a whole bunch of questions for me. How did you arrive at 8%? What's the calculation?
So there were a couple of questions, but one of them was, when you're in a difficult conversation, you know, do you say everything that you need to say when it gets difficult? And then what percent do you feel that you leave out? So there was a number of questions, and it actually came out at 7.56% is what people, claim that they or said that they feel they leave out of a difficult conversation. And so we rounded that up to 8%.
So it's self-reporting, and right off the bat, my brain wants to challenge that 8% and say, I bet it's 28.
And you're not wrong. It's just a metaphor.
I know. I love it.
It's not meant to be an exact science. You're right. For some people, it's, and again, in a last 8% moment, there's two default behaviors, and this is also self-reported, but people identify that they either, and in our research, 68% of people, they avoid. They don't say that last 8%.
Yeah.
The other 32%, and I can fall into this category, I'm in that difficult conversation, someone's getting upset, rather than avoiding, I'm stepping in and coming on too strong, and now I'm making a mess.
Mm.
So we talk about people either being avoiders or make a messers.
Oh, it's so good.
And so it's really, you know, whether it's 8% or 32% or 4%, it's really about, can you, again, push through that discomfort, yet do it skillfully, it's 8% or 32%.
Yeah. No, I totally get that. I think that's right. And the percentage is, it's a range, I'm sure. My point is that my guess is that most people think they're good at it, but others aren't. And so, absolutely. Like if I'm being honest, I might say 8%. Yeah, leave about 8% on the table. I bet it's more than that if I really dig deep. You know what I mean? Like that, what I'm saying is that's a conservative number is probably, what would be my guess.
I think you're right. Particularly for the 68% that are avoiders.
Yeah.
Now for the 32% that are make a messers, that are just going to blurt it out and say it and get angry and upset. They're getting all 8% out. They're just doing it unskillfully. Both have a negative impact. Both affect performance. And so that's why we're focused. Both affect the culture.
What I do like about the 8% is it's doable. Mm. It's like if I'm leaving 8% on the table, it's not that much more to finish to complete the cycle, to strengthen the culture and the trust. Just takes another 8% that I'm leaving on the table.
Yes, except that your brain is working really hard not to say that 8%, because we are all wired to default to protection, not risk. So the brain doesn't want the other person upset at you. The brain doesn't want them to not like you. So the brain is trying to keep you from saying that last 8%. So it sounds easy, but that's where you have to understand the brain science of what's happening to you emotionally, so that you can then either push through it to say the last 8% or do it skillfully. So that's where the brain science comes in.
We have some psychological maturity live polls that we do with teams. They're anonymous, but they show up on the screen and questions like, does everyone feel comfortable challenging, peers, even leadership? And does everyone feel comfortable with conflict and all these things? And oftentimes the leaders are surprised by numbers that are lower than they hoped or thought.
Yes.
Because the leader thinks they're creating an environment. They say they want the openness, but for whatever reason, there's people feeling like, yeah, you say it, but we don't feel it. Yep. And so they're often surprised by some of the results in the room and they go, really? What's wrong? I mean, I thought we had an open thing. And so I'm saying all that to just ask you this question. In your experience, in your research, does this really come down more on the leader not realizing that they're not creating that safety? And they think they are, but they're not.
Sometimes that's the answer. Sometimes what they don't recognize, though, is, people come to work and they have their previous experiences. And so they may have been in a culture and environment before them where it wasn't safe to speak up, where they were reprimanded, where there were negative repercussions. Well, the emotional memory, the cortisol effect, then affects them. So even though that leader themselves is open, people never step in because they've had that previous experience. So as a leader, you have to work even harder to have that conversation. And one of the things we do when we work with teams is talk about, what kind of culture do they want to have? What does it look like to be a high-performing team? And what happens when someone feels they need to point out a mistake or challenge a status quo or name an inconvenient truth? That's actually, in our assessment, the question that typically teams score lowest on is, we name inconvenient truths, difficult to discuss issues on our team. Because that's hard, because you're calling someone out, someone might get upset. But we all know what happens when inconvenient truths aren't named. Then the issue doesn't get resolved. Then there's a meeting after the meeting to talk about the thing that wasn't said in the meeting. And so it's incredibly unproductive, yet it's just so hard for people to do.
It is hard for people to do. It's harder for people to get it back when it goes off the rails, though. Like you say, if you let it go and it becomes toxic and dysfunctional and all that, it's so hard to reel it back in then at that point, because it's all about trust, you know, in relationships. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In our, we did another research study where we looked at, you know, what are the two kind of key factors, pillars in a high performing culture? And this is backed up by some of Sarah Sewell's work at Stanford. And there's really two. There's connection, mm-hmm. which is people feel they have a voice. People feel valued, psychological safety. They feel cared for. The second is courage, the ability to do difficult things, to name an inconvenient truth, to have an accountability conversation, to speak up, you know, when they don't think something's right. And so a high-performing culture does have both. However, we say that connection comes before courage. Because, and that's that trust piece. Patrick, if I know that you have my back, and I know that you believe in me, and you give me some difficult feedback, I'm way more open to it than if I'm like, I don't know where Patrick's coming from. I don't know who he is, you know. So that whole trust connection piece is what enables the courage and the accountability and the risk-taking to happen.
That is so true. And even though you trust the person, you have a good relationship with the person, it always stings a little. Oh, you know, it's like always. You hear some. No one wants to hear somebody else say, hey, you know, you didn't show up quite the way I would expect you to show up. And I know that's not you, but I just wanted to share. It's like...
One of the examples I always use is, you know, I want you to imagine you get some feedback in an email, and I'm not advocating feedback in email.
Right,
it's a metaphor, but you're going to get an email, and you get two of them, and they're going to have exactly the same words and feedback, but one comes from a leader who you admire, who you respect, who you know has your best interest, and one comes from a leader who you don't like, is toxic. Are you going to react differently to those two emails? Completely differently.
100% you are. 100%.
So that's why that whole idea that connection, that trust, that knowing somebody cares about me, that as a leader, you know, you demonstrating that you do care and have somebody's best interest is critical to then unlocking that ability to give feedback, to hold people accountable, to make decisions that someone doesn't agree with. Because that's always hard.
So... To cut ahead a little bit, and we could never cover this in an hour podcast, but to get to the 8%,
mm-hmm.
what's the path? What are the tenets that you teach that help people cover the last 8%?
Yeah. So if you think of those two things I described, the 50%, that each are 50%, the culture and the environment, that's about a team having open discussions about what I mentioned this, what kind of culture they want to have, how they're going to show up when they need to challenge each other, how they're going to, so it's there's some tenets that the team agree to. And so that's really clear. Individually, then, how do you ensure that there's that empathy and care and that courage? That's where the emotional intelligence work comes in. That's where the performing under pressure work comes in, because it's actually the emotional brain that gets triggered and jumps in and says, nope, not safe. Don't speak up. Don't say that, or don't make that decision. Don't take that risk. So that's where people really need to learn about their emotional brain in order to both do empathy and care and take risks.
Man, we're doing some very similar work, Bill. It's really cool. It's affirming. We did a full day culture mapping workshop with the team the other day. And my partner, one of our coaches, he made the statement in the beginning. He said, look, we're going to design today. We're going to do some culture design, literally articulate the way you want the culture to be.
Yeah.
But that's the small part of this. You then have to execute on it, which means everybody has to practice it and be mutually accountable for it. And he goes, but there's a third piece. You have to believe you can do it. I mean, there are people in these culture mapping workshops that they go through the motions and they'll, yeah, I'll be here. My boss told me to be here. I'll put some good things on the flip chart, but I don't believe we're ever going to get there.
Yeah.
So, you know, you gotta imagine it. Then you have to practice it and you have to believe it.
Let me add all of that. Yes. And you have to practice it in the difficult moments.
Oh, that's where, that's it. That's where it shows
up. Because that's what people remember, but that's the place where it's hardest to show up with curiosity when someone's challenging something when you think you're right.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's, so it is all, so yes, define the culture, define the values, but then you actually have to have the tools and skills to practice it in what we call the last 8% moments.
In the difficult moments. So good. I mean, it's easy to practice it in the happy times. The other thing, the flip side of that is we tell people that their culture map is a mirror they should be holding up to each other.
Yeah.
But in the good and the bad moments.
Yes.
So what people will often do is they'll hold it up when they see somebody not following and they'll go, we said this. What leaders often neglect to do, not purposefully, but just consciously, is hold it up when they do see it functioning the way, like, hey, this was even in the difficult moments. Hey, I just want you to know, Bill, that meeting this morning was tough. The way mm-hmm. you navigated that with respect and empathy and you listened yeah. and you just stayed quiet and let that person really, that was culture map point number 4 to the T. You modeled it. Thank you for that. So that sort of mirror, not only when it's going bad, but when it's going good, that's when it's important. It's that positive reinforcement is what does good look like? You got to recognize it when you see it.
Yeah. And by the way, I love that because the other question that organizations typically score really low on is I feel valued for the work that
yeah,
I do.
Yeah.
People don't give enough feedback. They don't get enough positive reinforcement. In fact, we actually had a meeting internally. So my business partner and I, JP, we run the company. We've hired a president to manage the training and consulting part of our business. And there's a tough decision that needs to be made. And we literally asked him in a meeting yesterday, why haven't you made this decision yet? And he sat and he thought, he's very reflective. And he said, you know, I don't know. And JP was great. He said, I so appreciate you. You could have tried to make up an answer. You just owned it. You just said, I don't know. And so we really reinforced that vulnerability, that not having to be perfect, that, you know, not having an answer and being able to say, I don't know. So yes, that validation of the positive behaviors is also missing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you're reminding me of some of Brené Brown's work around vulnerability and the ability to be authentic and say, I don't know. You know, I'm struggling with that, you know, I'm grappling with it.
And if you're like me and you got promoted because you were, you know, good at your job and relatively high in IQ and technical skills, you assume then, well, I got promoted because I have all the answers and I'm right all the time. And then you run around feeling like you have to be right. And you can't say, I don't know, or you can't say I need help because that's not why you got promoted. And so I really struggled early in my career with that. I thought you had to be the smartest guy in the room. And I've learned it's exactly the opposite. You want to be the dumbest guy in the room and have a lot of really great, smart people around you.
We have centered on a word in our work lately. I have centered on a work lately and on a word in my work, conversations. Mm. And I'm finding myself just coming back to, dude, that's the solution. I did an employee engagement workshop with an organization up in Virginia. And at the end of the workshop, we did the thing where we said, hey, you know, anyone have any final takeaways or aha moments that you want to share? And this young lady in the back said, I have something. And I said, sure. And she says, throughout this workshop, I've written down a word about a dozen times or more. I said, what word is it? She looked at her paper and she said, conversations. Mm. And I said, what about them? She goes, have them. Have them. It's those conversations we're not having that this stuff ain't just going to fix itself. It's only going to get worse and worse and worse. So have them. And we talked about it a little more and, you know, sort of organically came on. Yeah, there's two things. One, we have to have them. Mm-hmm. Two, we have to have them well.
Yes.
Now we have to know how to have them.
Yes.
But I'm finding more and more, Bill, I don't want to oversimplify it, but I'm finding more and more. And that's what all this 95% of the challenges that I see in the workplace when I'm coaching leaders and teams mm-hmm. is people aren't having the right conversations at the right time with the right people in the right way. It's conversations.
Yeah, I have two things to say about that. Number one, you're absolutely right. I mean, at the end of a session or in coaching, the number one thing people struggle with is they come to me, I have to have a difficult conversation with my boss, my peer, my employee, my spouse, my daughter, right? And so that is absolutely the number one thing that we struggle with. That's the thing that is most relevant for people. The thing that we've added that we hear now so much that is required for high performing teams is also the tough decisions. And that ability to take risks. So it isn't only the conversations, because if we're not trying new things or we're not taking risks, we're not going to be innovative, we're not going to be entrepreneurial. And so that whole decision risk-taking, I mean, that's going to be a whole section in our upcoming book. Conversations is also going to be a section, but it really is both. And sometimes, you know, I think there's too much focus on the conversations and not enough on, am I making decisions that, you know, where I'm not avoiding getting in trouble or looking bad or failing, right? Am I making decisions where I'm taking smart risks?
I love it. I don't think they're two completely different things. I mean, I would think that in decision making, conversations are a big part of being able to do that well and do that right. You know, who's involved in the decision? How do we at least communicate the decisions we're making, even if we know you're not going to like them? So they overlap. I think
as you say that. I mean, I'll give you an example of a decision I made to avoid a tough conversation. So when I was working in a computer software company, I was a VP of sales. I had to very hard charging, very loud salespeople who had both contributed to a large complex sale, and they both felt they earned the 100% commission. And I knew that the right thing to do was to actually split the commission, but I did not want to deal with either of them getting upset or angry. So I went to my boss and I lobbied to pay them both, and it was about $30,000 or $40,000 difference. And this was 30 years ago, and I remember to this day, I still regret not having the strength to go to each of them and say, hey, this is the decision I've made. You both contributed 50% versus, you know, giving in and costing the company money. So to me, it is, I mean, that was avoiding a tough conversation, but it was a decision I made not to take that risk.
I've experienced almost the exact sort of scenario, Bill, many years ago, back in a former life. I worked in a sales role where we had a commission structure set up for the month, and we blew it out of the water. My team blew it out of the water. And my director came back and said, we didn't expect numbers this high, and we don't have the budget for the structure and the percentage that we set. And I said, man, I'm really sorry about your budget, but we want our money. Like, I want mine. You know, I want my bonus for this. That's what this, you know, this was the thing. And she told me, she was super vulnerable and honest with me. She said, Patrick, I can't go to my director. I can't do this. And so my ability to have a conversation with her that was difficult to say, no, you figure it out in the budget. This was the deal. My people worked under this construct. Her inability to have a conversation with her boss about, hey, you know what? They blew away our expectations, and we're gonna have to eat a little bit of this. And, you know, in the future, we'll look at a different structure. But she couldn't do that. And she ended up writing me a personal check for the difference.
Wow. That, talk about costing you personally.
That's how much she was unwilling to have the conversation.
That literally cost her. What we like to talk about is the idea of pushing into the discomfort in order to avoid long-term regret. It's either the short-term discomfort and anxiety or long-term regret. And 30 years later, I still feel the regret of not having pushed into the discomfort of that decision. And we've all had that experience. Sometimes it is a decision about having a conversation that we're making. But it can also be, you know, I had a CEO who, you know, they wanted to do an acquisition, and he felt like he needed to get more information. And by then they lost the opportunity because he spent too long analyzing, and it ended up, somebody else ended up acquiring that company, and it was a really good acquisition. He said, I lost that opportunity to acquire that company because I waited too long. I wasn't willing to take the risk. And so there is a pure decision risk part of our jobs that also drives performance.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me shift, since you use the word performance, let's segue into that term for a minute.
Sure.
And again, I've done a lot of work recently on what I call a value creating continuum, which is, yes, you want high performance, but you can be high performing and not creating the value your stakeholders are looking for from you, mm-hmm. right? So there's busyness, and then there's productivity, and then there's high performance, and then there's value creation.
Yep, I like that.
And your this book, I want to talk a little bit about this in particular, performing under pressure. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the first things I read in the book was that people don't perform better under pressure, even though they'll say they do.
There's a myth.
I want to know more about that.
Yeah. No, there's a myth that under pressure, we suddenly develop new capabilities, but that actually doesn't happen. If you look at Michael Jordan, he had better, he was a better free throw percentage shooter in the fourth quarter than everyone else, but it was still, he was still less than his previous three quarters. He was just less worse than everyone else. So he performed up to his capability. And that kind of takes the pressure off. You go into a high stakes situation, you don't have to suddenly perform and be someone you're not. You have enough. You just have to perform up to your capabilities. And so that was one of the key tenets of that book, is that don't put that pressure on yourself to suddenly become somebody you're not.
Yeah, that's good. I do believe that clutch is a real thing. Like, mm-hmm. I think there are some athletes and some other performers who there really is this clutch. I mean, they make a reputation out of it, that in the bottom of the ninth inning or with two outs and you're behind, this is who you want at the plate. They're just clutch. Yep. They just somehow they get in a zone. What is it? They get in a zone, or they have the ability to calm themselves or whatever. They're just clutch. And clutch has to do with being under pressure, meaning I need a hit more now than I've ever needed you to hit. And the Michael Jordans are clutch. The Tiger Woods were clutch. My guy, Albert Pujols with the Cardinals, right? He was just known as a clutch. Like, there's a reason.
Yeah, I mean, we did a lot of research. There was no sport or athlete that we could find that actually performed better under pressure than they did when they weren't under pressure.
They just performed better than others.
Who performed closer to their capabilities. And you name them, Tiger Woods, Albert Pujols, Michael Jordan. They performed up to their capability. They didn't let the pressure diminish them, but they didn't suddenly develop new and better capabilities. Yeah.
Great distinction. It took me a second. I got it. Yep. I got it. Yeah. And so they're better at not letting the pressure make them crumble than their teammates.
Correct. And then everyone else.
Oh, that's really interesting. Really interesting. Because
we tend to remember the clutch shots. Michael Jordan, he said, I can't tell you how many fourth quarter shots I've missed, game winning shots I've missed.
That's right.
You don't remember them.
Yeah.
You know, he just hit a lot more than anyone else.
And so he got a reputation for it. That's so good.
Well, and he is literally better than others at not getting diminished. Right. So he deserves that reputation. It's just the idea that he's actually better in those moments than when he doesn't have the pressure.
Interesting. Misinterpreted. So I read a book recently called The Upside of Stress. Mm. And it is newish research on how stress is not what's hurting us. Our relationship with stress is what's hurting us. And the upside of stress is some of the research that says stress, and this might challenge what you're saying here, but I'm interested in it, that stress actually does make us perform. The stress of an interview, the adrenaline that comes with, I'm in a job interview, or I'm in a tight situation, dangerous situation in traffic, or I'm whatever it is, or I'm in a clutch. I'm in the bottom of the ninth with two outs. Yes. Where the stress mechanism, if our relationship with stress and our attitude towards stress is healthy, it actually does make us perform better. But I guess my question would be, are you defining stress and pressure synonymously? You think those are two different things?
No, what do you think is the relationship? There's a whole chapter in the book about stress versus pressure.
Okay.
And you are absolutely right. Even back then, 10 years ago, there was research that suggests that stress can trigger us to take action. Yeah. Stress can trigger us to get more focused. It's just when it's like a continuum, when that stress pushes over into anxiety.
Good. Yeah.
That's when our cognitive abilities start to get diminished. That's when our motor skills start to get diminished. Yeah. So yes, it's you're right. It's that. So as we feel that stress, we talk to athletes when they start to feel that performance pressure, to say to themselves, that's my body getting ready to perform.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to feel that stress.
Yeah.
It's when they let that stress overwhelm them and then they start worrying. Like we worked with a tennis player who said, you know, whenever I was returning a serve while I was waiting, I would be thinking, what if I do this wrong? What if I'm in the wrong place? Versus staying present, being really, like we really coached him to, and his return service percentage went up dramatically. And so it really is that relationship as you experience the stress. How are you processing that? What are you saying to yourself? How are you managing that? That's the key. So we're saying the same thing, I think.
Do you work with a lot of, is that part of your work is in the sports arena? Because performance is performance and stress and all that. And, you know, do you have to be a tennis expert to coach someone on those kinds of things? So how much do you spend in that field?
So I've only done a little bit of work with athletes and I love it. My business partner, JP, he's done a lot more work with athletes. He's worked with Olympic athletes. He's worked with NBA coaches. So he's got a lot more experience. And so a lot of, you know, what I know about work with Olympic athletes is from his experience.
Yeah. But the Institute, that's part of your portfolio.
Works with athletes.
Yeah. That's fascinating because I find, you know, I use sports analogies all the time and a lot of people do. And some people are like, here comes another sports analogy. This is different, Patrick. This isn't sports. Mm-hmm. But there are so many real parallels where it's no different. I mean, you just said it, the Michael Jordan, it's no, the CEO of a Fortune 500 company who's, you know, had profit loss for the last 3 months and their shareholders are breathing down their throats. And Michael Jordan, whose team is behind in Game 7 of some of those tenets and the response, it's
exactly the same. It's
sector agnostic.
Physiological system.
Yeah.
But it's responding. If you're selling somebody and the client's objecting and you feel like you're losing the sale, that's no different from it's a volleyball team who's down 10-3 and you feel like you're losing. It's exactly the same physiological system, which is why we're able to take the learnings from working with Olympic athletes and apply them to business people, because it's the same part of the brain that's responding and reacting.
So again, with the, you know, much like you gave the tenets of how to get to the 8%, the book is Performing Under Pressure, The Science of Doing Your Best When It Matters Most.
Yeah.
What are those several key tenets help people sort of think about how to be their best at their most pressing times?
So the second section has 22 pressure solutions. Mm. I don't love all of them, but there's a couple that are really my go-to. One is, and this is just so obvious, is the breathing. We just know that the intake of oxygen minimizes the physiological effect of the stress chemicals the amygdala has released. So everybody knows it. It's just people forget to do it. So the breathing is one.
Let me pause you there, because this is really, it's fascinating you say that. You say everybody knows it. I think everybody's heard it. Breathe. Don't forget to breathe.
But what you just said, you blew by
it fast, but I want you to say it again, because it's not just a spiritual breathe and collect yourself. You gave a biological, physiological reality that is, and I want you to say that again about the oxygen and all that, because that's what people don't know.
Okay. So when we are triggered emotionally and our stress hormones are triggered, the cortisol that gets released, in addition to causing memories to sear in, it actually reduces working memory, which is where we do our complex thinking. So when we are triggered, when we are stressed, we actually can't think as clearly. And by the way, we become more judgmental. We become more certain that we're right. We're not in a good place to perform. Mm-hmm. The intake of a large amount of oxygen acts as the physiological effect of minimizing those chemicals so that you clear the chemicals out of the brain and the body so that you can think more clearly. So we always say it's not, you know, EQ or IQ, it's EQ and IQ. If you can manage your emotions, then you can use the best of your thinking.
You made me think of a computer analogy. Tell me if I'm anywhere near this. We have an operating system and we have a hard drive that has lots of stuff on it. So we have the abilities, we have the knowledge, we have the expertise. But computers also use what's called RAM. Random access memory, and you called it working memory a minute ago.
Correct.
But that is what we're using right now.
Yes.
And that's not hard drive space. That's processor and memory capability of handling, for example, 12 applications open on my computer. the breathing shuts down the seven applications I don't really need to be focusing on right now so that the other five work smoother and faster and I don't have latency.
Yes.
I mean, that's what it sounded like to me when you said it. I don't know why that picture came in my head.
I actually compare the working memory to RAM.
Yeah.
The other thing the breathing does, it also shuts down the app, the one that's judging, the one that's needing to be right, the one that's not listening.
The one that's in the background.
Only listening to confirm their point of view.
Yeah.
So there's a whole bunch of,
oh my gosh,
when we get triggered emotionally, there's a whole bunch of apps that are not helping.
And you don't see them. You don't see them because they're not open. So you don't even know they're running. Their
that's
process
correct.
Is running in the background. And we don't know that these judgments and assumptions and storytelling
certainty
in our brain is even,
right,
oh
and
gosh.
All of that is going on. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Man, that was fantastic. I love that you pulled.
Yeah, by the way, if the only thing your listeners do as a result of us this conversation is the next time they're in a difficult moment or they have to take a risk or have a conversation, they just take a couple deep breaths, they'll be so much more powerful. We will have accomplished something. We'll have given them something.
Listen, I will do it. I'm a huge you're going to love this. Don't disconnect from this call when I say this.
Okay.
But my listeners know I'm an avid lifelong St. Louis Cardinals fan. Mm. And we have a rookie pitcher just came up this year that I am loving. He just has so much poise and he's already doing really well. When I watch him pitch, I've seen basketball players at the free throw line take some dribbles and then take a deep breath, right?
Yeah.
I've seen golfers take a deep breath before they putt. This pitcher of ours, his name's Michael McGreevy, you can see his cheeks and he's not out of breath. He's taking more breaths. Almost between every pitch, he is going about three times. And I'm going, man.
Right now, it's so effective at calming ourselves.
It is. It just, and you look at his poise and his demeanor, and he gets it. He's either been taught this, or he's, you know, following some instruction, or he just naturally. Yeah. But it's noticeable. It's a real noticeable thing.
It's absolutely one of the things we do with Olympic athletes is work on the breathing and executives.
Yeah.
I want to share one more strategy for one more strategy from the book that I find so helpful that I know other people do too. So when we're facing a difficult moment where we might have some doubts, a big presentation or a tough decision or a tough conversation we have to have, we have two systems in our brain. One's our internal activation system. So that's when we try to do self-talk. Oh, I'm going to be good at this. This is going to go great. The problem with self-talk is we have that other little voice that says, no, you're not.
Yeah.
Oh, this is going to go great. No, it isn't. All these things are going wrong. So we have that internal critic.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's really hard to overcome that internal critic. So we have a strategy called recall you at your best that actually engages your external activation system, where you think about a time when you did something similar, something exactly the same, you did something similar and you were successful.
Yeah.
Then you start to see yourself and you actually start to feel yourself being successful. And so that overcomes, you start to believe that you can do it. That overcomes that internal voice. So an example I use is probably 4 or 5 years ago, I was asked, actually much longer than that, I wrote the book 10 years ago. But I was asked to give a presentation to 100 US Marines. And I'm not a military guy. The most nervous I've ever been was driving over to Fort Sheridan here in Chicago, thinking, I don't know what Marines do when they don't like a speaker, but it can't be good. And I was imagining all the things that could go wrong. My first thought was, I should probably use the strategies from the book we wrote about performing under pressure. It was a last 8% moment for me. So I remembered the same thing happened to me when I had to deliver this training to surgeons. Here I'm going to try and describe the brain to people who've dissected it. Like, they're going to disagree with me. It was the complete opposite. It went so well. They're like, yep, that's exactly how the brain works. And this stuff really affects me. And they loved it. So I just saw myself having the success with the surgeons. Did the deep breathing, and man, I remember walking up, that's being so confident, walking up to the stage after being, you know, the most nervous I'd ever been, and it actually ended up going really well. So that recall you at your best can be a really powerful strategy when you're feeling anxious or nervous about a high-pressure situation.
I have two things to add to that. It's affirming to hear you say that and give sort of a little more of a scientific backing for it. I have called it history of success. And I'll do this with individual coachees who are sort of, you know, doubting, or someone doesn't have the confidence in them, or, you know, or is it, am I feeling imposter syndrome?
Yeah.
And we'll build a history of success. Tell me about all your accomplishments. And then just, no, let's list them. Go ahead. Just get, name some. I don't care. Well, I was the, you know, senior fellow at such and such. I graduated top of my class in such and such. I won this award. I achieved this in fewer time, all the things. And then I have them read the list back and go, now, who are you again? Some imposter, you know? So we call it history of success. Yes. There's for our listeners and friends of faith out there, there is scripture around the psalmist David, who we all know the story of David and Goliath. Mm-hmm. But what David did, there's a verse that says, David was greatly distressed, but David encouraged himself in the Lord. He encouraged himself. And what he had to draw back from was the time that he killed a lion with his bare hands, and a time when he slew a bear with his bare hands. And he drew on those experiences and encouraged himself. And so there, you know, there's a scripture behind it for those.
He didn't know it, but he was using the recall you at your best.
He's building a history of success. That's right.
That's great. I love that example.
Yeah, man. Gosh, this is just another one of those topics we could do, you know, every episode on now we could make this the podcast forever. There's so much to unpack here. Mm-hmm. I really do appreciate, your bringing your knowledge. It's a unique blend of knowledge and expertise that you have. And I can,
thank you.
I've definitely picked up on that in this conversation. Learned some cool things. Bill, there's two questions I like to ask all my guests before we wrap a show, because I love the stories and the different tenets. Always pick up a good nugget. And the first one I would like to ask you is, who comes to mind for you as a leader in your life, whether you even know them or not, mm-hmm. but a leader in your life that you would say has had profound impact or influence on your leadership and your view of leadership and why?
Yeah, so probably the very first real leader that I had when I worked at a computer software company, his name was Peter Hamilton. And he was the president of a company. It was a small software company, and I was a brand new, just fresh out of school. He just saw something in me. He believed in me. He saw more for me than I knew I was capable of. So number one, he just believed in me. But number two, he would give me feedback. He could be abrupt. He didn't always have a lot of time, but he would say, Bill, you just messed this up. But I'd be like, oh my God, I messed it up. I want to get better, because I knew he believed in me. So it was that balance of connection. I felt valued. I felt believed in. I felt loved. Literally, I felt loved. But he also had the courage to take the risk to give me feedback. And so he was just a great example for me of a great leader.
That's so consistent with everything you've been saying. And even in our pre-conversation we had a few weeks ago, I wrote this down. You said that we have to carry high care and high accountability at the same time.
Exactly.
And that, you know, some of us have read Kim Scott's Radical Candor, you know, sort of same sort of thing. You can care about people and hold them accountable at the same time. They're not mutually exclusive.
That's there's definitely some overlap with Radical Candor. The part for us that we add is around that decision-making and the risk-taking.
Yeah.
So there's definitely some Radical Candor elements to it. But as I said, it's, you know, life is more than just about having conversations.
That's
it's also about taking those risks and you know, making those tough decisions.
Yeah, that's good. Last question. Mm-hmm. You're at the top of a mountain. All the leaders of the world are at the base of the mountain, and you got a giant megaphone to give them the Bill Benjamin tenet of leadership, the 15-second soundbite that's most important thing for all leaders to keep in mind. What are you telling them?
Just don't live with regret. Just step into those last 8% moments. Push through that discomfort, learn the skills to do it well, but push into that tough conversation. You know, you need to have, we know when we didn't say everything we needed to say. We know when we're not making the best decision like the one I described, and then we live with regret. And so just take that risk and you will find huge impact in both your business and personal life.
Beautifully said. Folks, get the book Performing Under Pressure. The Science of Doing Your Best When It Matters Most. And be on the lookout for the next one. Bill, when's it? Is there? Do you have a timeline for the 8% book coming out?
Yeah, because we're going to be going through a traditional publisher, it's probably about a year.
Okay.
So folks are going to have to be patient, but look for the last 8%. There is also a Harvard Business Review article coming up on this subject in the fall. So look for the Harvard Business Review article in the fall.
Awesome. Well, well done, man. Thanks for carving out time and sharing such great insight. IHHP.com. Again, we'll post it on our episode page. And go, man, this is one to like go back and listen to it again. Share it with a friend. Lead on, folks.